Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The theme from the classic movie, Jaws, a film based on the most famous book about sharks ever written. Both forever changed how many, if not most of us, think about summer vacations at the ocean and getting into the water. Before Jaws, we never gave it a second thought. Now there's an undercurrent of dread about the dangers of the deep, specifically hungry, maniacal sharks, teeth bared, and targeting us. But both the book and the movie got it all wrong. True, there are reports every summer about shark attacks on swimmers at the shore, many occurring in nearby South Carolina. But the fact is, we are far more dangerous to them than they are to us. Think about this. Sharks kill about 4 humans a year on average. We kill 100 million sharks every year. 100 million. And following the release of the movie, we went on the attack. Which of us is more dangerous? Ponder that for a while. As August beach vacations loom large, we want to explore the myths about sharks that permeate our culture and learn more about the creatures that perhaps play the most important role in the ecology of the ocean and therefore our world and our survival. William McKeever is the author of Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. He is also the founder of Safeguard the Seas, an ocean conservation organization, and a documentary filmmaker. And he joins us this morning by phone. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us by phone is Dr. Joel Fodry, a marine ecologist and associate professor at the UNC Chapel Hill Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City. His lab helps run the shark survey program that counts, studies, and tags sharks off the North Carolina coast. He's also with us by phone. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
I should mention that William McKeever will be here in town at Park Road Books on Wednesday of this week at 7 o'clock to show pieces of his film and also to sign books. So, William, prior to the book and particularly the movie Jaws, there were certainly shark attacks. What was it about Jaws, the entertainment, the book and the movie, that so changed the equation and how we human beings thought about these creatures?
Yeah, Mike. Well, when Jaws came out in 1975, people were obviously aware of sharks. But what changed with the movie was this concept that sharks are somehow lurking out there in the ocean for us. And it's just not true. Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws, had a very successful novel on his hand and sold 20 million books. But sadly, it was too successful because it created this myth of the shark as someone or some creature that's going to be out there harming us. And the data and history shows that is not true. And Peter Benchley spent the rest of his life trying to undo what he had done. And he regretted actually writing the book. And even though he is gone, his wife continues his work to change this opinion that has been so harmful for sharks.
And I understand from reading your book that he got the idea for his book from this theory that developed after something happened in 1916 when over a 10-day period, 4 people were killed in the water by sharks. And that launched what I guess was the first extensive shark hunt in history. If that's true, why wasn't that event the one that perpetuated our fear of sharks? Why haven't we had that fear? I don't remember being afraid of sharks in the 50s and 60s in the ocean. So why wasn't that event top of mind?
Yeah. Well, of course, 1916, that was before the advent of television and all these media stations all clamoring for something to get and attract viewers. And so the issue was forgotten. And then by the time the 1975 rolled around, you had a completely different environment and a whole generation that had no idea about sharks. And this is where they received their education about sharks. That combined with a media world that was created by the 70s, where they're hungry for information, hungry for viewers, the two collided. And so now, when there's ever any kind of shark encounter, the media pounces on this, gets back to the Jaws myth, and has a great opportunity to attract viewers, and the public just has not been educated on the real truth about sharks, that they are not these creatures that they that are portrayed in either 1916 Attack or the 1975 movie.
What changed author Peter Benchley's mind about his work and the success of his work and what it did to people's perception of sharks and in turn what it did to our interaction with sharks? What made him change his mind?
Yeah, Mike, that's a good question. And, you know, what happened was Peter Benchley was on a dive on the Cocos Islands. And this is a place where they sadly fin sharks. And by that, I mean, they'll catch the shark, fin it alive, sell the fins for shark fin soup, and they'll throw the shark overboard. And without its fins, it's certainly going to drift to the bottom of the sea and die. And it's a cruel death. And he was scuba diving, and he saw these sharks littering the seafloor. And he realized his great mistake was that he took away any empathy for sharks. Because what happened was that while sharks were being butchered and massacred at fishing operations around the world, nobody really cared. And so he went on his on a mission in his life after that event, and he spoke around the country. He did videos. He created an institution to try to turn what he had done around.
So Dr. Joel Fodry is also with us. He's a marine ecologist and associate professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Institute of Marine Sciences. And according to Mr. McKeever's book, Doctor, the United States is the country with the highest number of shark attacks. He quotes George Burgess, who is a marine biologist at the University of Florida, the keeper of the International Shark Attack File, as saying that the U.S. is ground zero, accounting for about half of the world's shark attacks. Florida evidently experiences about 50% of the whole total of shark attacks in the U.S., with no other state even coming close. But after that, it is South Carolina, Hawaii, and California. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that sounds right. And if and I think if you look at the data, sort of beach visits each year, those states are going to rank high, as would North Carolina. People don't realize that North Carolina is a really frequently visited beach destination. And in fact, in the U.S., we're sort of fourth behind Florida, California, and Hawaii.
Hmm. So is the number of shark attacks on humans in those states because there are so many people in the water or because of the fact that we have a larger coastline than most states? California certainly does. Florida has two coastlines. Is that why? What would be the reason?
Yeah, I think it just largely reflects that we have a lot of people in the water, sort of spring, summer, and fall. And so, yeah, you have the opportunity for people and sharks to every great once in a while come into contact.
You've said that you are actually surprised that we don't have a greater incident of shark attacks on humans, particularly in our state, even though over the last 80 years, our state has had roughly 80 attacks. That's one a year. So why are you surprised the number isn't higher?
Well, yeah, one a year to me is just a remarkably low number when you think about the millions of hours that people do spend in the water. You know, the coastal ocean is a place where sharks have always been throughout their evolutionary history. And to me, that number certainly signifies that sharks are by and large very wary of people. The cues that we send out, the cues that sharks are looking for, just do not line up. You know, I think we've all seen videos, the overhead shots now of people in the water and sharks nearby. And I guess I'm not surprised, but I would note that the people seem sort of amazed by that.
Actually, I had not seen them until this past weekend getting ready for this show. I did watch them, and you can, these overhead, I guess they're drone shots. People are in the water cavorting, and all around them are these sharks. That's always been the case, right?
Well, it's not like, you know, every time you're in the water are you, you know, that close to a shark perhaps. But, yeah, I mean, sharks occupy the nearshore environment. And so when you go to the beach or you're out on the water, somewhere in your field of view underneath the water, you know, there are sharks. A lot of those sharks are small. North Carolina has over 50 different species of sharks that we know have shown up in our waters. and it's sharp nose and black nose and black tips, and those are, you know, 3, 4, 5 foot long sharks. We also have duskies and silkies and sandbars, which can be a little longer, and occasionally, yeah, we have bull sharks and tiger sharks that are around. So it's a pretty big diversity of species. And yes, they are in the estuaries and along the beaches and a little offshore. So when you think about, you know, the sharks are in that environment, and again, people, more and more people are going to the beach, spending time in the water. To be talking about one or two or three of these encounters, to me, is a remarkably low number. Certainly not to be rooting for any higher than that. But that, to me, is very strong evidence that sharks are fairly wary. And I often say that the sharks are looking to do three things. They are looking to find food. At some point, they're looking to find a mate. And then they spend almost all the rest of their time trying to avoid risk. A lot of their anatomical adaptations, a lot of their behavioral adaptations, strike me as being very risk-averse. When they do want to find food, that food can often fight back. And so sharks have evolved to be a little skittish. And in those overhead shots, you might note none of those instances result in an encounter or a bite or an attack.
Right.
I think if you watch those videos long enough, you'd see the shark at some point probably wigs out and kind of moves away.
Yeah, you, and William McKeever, you say in your book that we are not on the menu for sharks. They don't particularly, they're not attracted to us. They don't know what we are. They're not looking for us. And that's where Peter Benchley went wrong, because he gave people the intent, the idea that sharks are, they're laser focused on eating us.
Yeah, that myth that, you know, you go in the water and you think, well, if there's a shark nearby and he sees me, I'm going to be eaten alive. That concept. And it's sad, because summer is a great time to enjoy the ocean, and people waste so much psychic energy on it. It's something that, actually, I'm on a mission to reverse, to tell people, go out, enjoy the ocean, and don't even think about it.
When you look at those overhead shots, though, and it's not the case all the time, but in these films that have made the internet, this drone footage, you see these sharks. Now, they're small, they're large, they're maybe different breeds, I don't know, but they're out there, and they're all around these people who are standing in the water throwing beach balls around. Should that not give us pause?
No, not at all. And,
okay.
I'll step back, because I think, as Joel mentioned, that most of the sharks are, the 500 species, most of them are actually quite small. It's only the big ones, the great white, the hammerhead, the mako, the tiger, that we need to be a little concerned. And I certainly would get out of the water if they're spotted. But keep in mind, a shark like the great white needs blubber. They need energy to power their tremendous distances they go in the water. For example, a great white shark was tracked going from South Africa to Australia and back in the space of 2 months. And to do that kind of a journey, they need certain foods that are found in marine mammals like seals and turtles and dugongs. Humans, we are actually, to them, quite scrawny. And I had one scientist I spoke to that said that a great white actually had a human in its mouth and spit it out because it realized it wasn't the rich nutrients that they need. So again, we're not on the menu. Humans have been around for approximately 200,000 years. So we're just a strange object when they see us in the water, and they've got to leave and find something that is going to give them the food that they need to survive.
William McKeever is author of Emperors of the Deep, The Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. He's with us along with Dr. Joel Fodry with UNC Chapel Hill's Institute of Marine Sciences. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins. We're talking about sharks today because there's still a lot of summertime left. Still a lot of people going to the beach, and people are afraid sometimes of the beach because of Jaws, the book and the movie, which gave us the idea that great white sharks are out there and all they want is to dine on us. Not true. William McKeever is the author of Emperors of the Deep, The Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. He joins us by phone in advance of his trip to Park Road Books on Wednesday evening at 7. Dr. Joel Fodry is also with us, marine ecologist and associate professor at the UNC Chapel Hill Institute of Marine Sciences and part of the shark survey program that they have out there where they tag sharks, etc. We'll talk about that in a second. It's been discovered, Dr. Fodry, that sharks have electroreception. They use electronic fields that we don't have. And they also use sound waves to sense injured animals, but they usually stay away from what they aren't familiar with, which would be us. So why don't they stay away? Why do they even come close to us? We don't sound like, we don't look like, we don't taste like, we don't move like fish.
Well, the biggest part of it is obviously, you know, we're going into their environment along the beaches where most of the bites or encounters happen. You know, that is a place that sharks are foraging very regularly. So, you know, we come into their world, so to speak. And then along the beaches, and I'm speculating a bit here because it's a complex thing to try to understand these very, very rare events like a bite when it happens. But, you know, along the beaches, it can be quite turbulent. There can be sediment up in the water, so the visibility is low. There's a lot of commotion in terms of sound. And all the cues can kind of get muddled. And so we think that that plays a part, that without understanding the shark's motivation, whether it's aggression or defensive or mistaken identity is a concept that's talked about, I do think that sort of this muddling of all the cues plays a part, and the shark may have an instant to respond, and whatever it's trying to accomplish, it elicits these bites.
I know that somebody has recommended that if you want to avoid shark bites, then you find an area of the water where the water is clear, not so that you can see them, but so that they can see you and that they don't mistake you for a food, for a fish. But most people don't go very far out in the ocean. They stay in the surf line where the water is turbulent and where the sediment is up. So is it even possible to find a clear area of water, particularly in North Carolina?
You know, access is a big part of the issue there, and people don't have access to boats where they maybe can get to some of these places where it's not right along the beach. You know, I always feel very safe in the sounds. You know, inside we have a lot of these sound environments, bays and estuaries type environments. And it is a quieter environment. The water can be clear, and have certainly been around sharks in that environment and speculate that, yeah, they're able to sort of analyze their data perhaps a little more clearly. But there are places, some of those places in Florida, they sort of have a sandbar system off the beach. And while it might be quieter and now off that second sandbar, that's a place that sharks do patrol. And so you'd want to be careful of that. And okay. So that's a way of saying that, you know, when you're in the ocean, it's impossible to eliminate all risk. Again, we're in their world.
So, William McKeever, Dr. Fodry is a marine ecologist. You are a former Wall Streeter and New York City-based producer of films about ocean conservation. Why your interest in this topic?
Yeah, you know, I've always loved the ocean, and I remember a few years ago I stumbled on a shark tournament in Montauk, Long Island. And a shark tournament is where fishermen go out to catch the biggest fish for prize money. And when they're done and they get their tens of thousands of dollars in payouts, the sharks are literally chopped up and sent to a landfill. So it's like going out hunting lions and throwing them in the garbage. And I was so horrified at what had happened to these sharks. Scores of these beautiful sharks were killed that I decided to investigate, do something about it, and it drew me into their world. And as I continued to learn about them, I learned how fantastic they are and how crucial they are to the ocean. And I decided to devote my life to preserving these magnificent animals because they are so crucial to the oceans. We need sharks. And I can't imagine doing anything more important than saving the oceans and sharks than what I'm doing now. And that's really the basis of this whole book that I've written and the film is to educate people that we need sharks and they are being massacred and we have to stop that massacre right now for our own benefit.
You point out that these creatures have lived through 5 extinction-level events, including the one that killed off the dinosaurs. But now is the time that they're under their greatest threat in their entire 450-million-year history. It's from us, Why now, though? We've been around for a long time, too. What's happening today that makes us the biggest threat in their history?
Yeah, Mike, and our use of the ocean has just exploded. We have looked at the ocean as an unlimited supply of food and entertainment. And so with our mechanization, with the power that we have, with our technology, we are just overfishing the oceans. And and this is around the world. As I mentioned before, the Asian countries, particularly China, they like shark fin soup. So that's requiring 70 million sharks to be sacrificed for that. But in this country, we are overfishing the oceans. And in the Northeast, where I'm from, we have these longline operations where we set out this one big line and indiscriminately catch all kinds of fish, of course, including shark. And it is hurting their populations. These are animals that really don't reproduce very often, and when they do, they only have a few pups. And so when they're exposed to a fishery, they just can't stand up to it. Some species out in the Pacific Ocean, for example, duskies and oceanic white-tip sharks, their populations are down 80%. And when they are gone, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for them to come back.
I want to talk about these long lines that some of these professional fishermen throw out. You say that some of them are 100 miles long, and they have hooks placed intermittently on the lines, and they just drag these lines through the water, and whatever gets hooked is hooked, and then they reel them in over a period of time. And there's a photograph in your book of one of the sharks caught up in this, and he was so desperate to get off the line that he has essentially, and I'll pardon the expression, everybody listening, he has vomited up his stomach. He was so urgently trying to get rid of this, being hooked on the line. I think that's in your book.
Yes.
Are there no regulations?
There are some regulations in the United States for longline operations, and your description of it, Mike, is quite good. Sometimes, actually, the line is 150 miles long.
Wow.
And it's just sitting out there and getting everything from turtles to seabirds to fish, and these animals are dying. There are approximately 150,000 seabirds that are killed every year, a like number for turtles. And so in this country, we perhaps maybe a little bit better at it, but it's killing off a lot of makos in the Northeast. And we need to have some kind of regulations out in the Pacific Ocean, because right now it's literally the wild, wild west. There are no clear regulations, and it's rampant, and it is fishing out the oceans.
These creatures are 50 million years older than trees. So that would mean, I would think, that they predate the dinosaurs. Are they, Dr. Fadre, are they dinosaurs? Are they the last remnants of dinosaurs, like the birds?
I like to think of them as highly evolved. They are extremely, exceedingly good at what they do. If I may, I actually just want to comment. I also got involved with shark research actually through rodeos, maybe in a bit of a different way. In the Gulf of Mexico, they've had these tournaments for 80 years and so, different states. And the newspapers in those states made a record of what the largest sharks were being caught. And for a lot of fishery species, we lack that sort of long-term data. So we were able to look at those trends, from the 1920s, 50s, 70s, today, and see what size sharks were winning these tournaments. And the largest sharks were caught like right in the middle of the 1980s. And then the floor just sort of fell out. And nowadays they're catching sharks that are quarter the size.
What is that telling you?
Well, it speaks to what Mr. McKeever was talking about. These are vulnerable species. They grow to be quite large, but they sort of reproduce slowly. That's a recipe for vulnerability in terms of losing very large individuals within your population. And that 1980s coincided quite well with the long line catches in the Gulf of Mexico. So there was essentially like no fishery until like 1975. And in 1980, it sort of explodes, and it lasted less than 10 years, peaked very quickly, and then the catches just sort of dropped out. I think because it represented these aren't a guild of fish that are able to sustain that sort of pressure.
We have a question from Twitter. What separates a shark from a fish? Is it just a big fish? Is that all it is? Or is there something special about it?
Well, it is a fish. It's a cartilaginous fish. So the sharks and rays are, they're not bony fishes. And that does separate them at the most basic level.
Okay.
Just add to that that their structure is very different. For example, fish have swim bladders that allow them to float. Sharks don't have swim bladders, so they have to keep moving. And they power their great migrations through the oil in their liver, which the shark liver is their biggest organ. And so they're all combined with their tentacles on the outside. Those tentacles give them great speed. They are remarkably adapted for ocean life and being an apex predator.
We kill 100 million sharks a year around the globe. Clearly, that cannot be sustainable. How are most of them being killed? Through these fishing expeditions or because of the finning of these sharks for shark fin soup? Are we eating them as shark steak? How are they being killed and why?
Yeah, so the main reason is for shark fin soup. So of the 100 million, 70 million of them are being killed for that purpose. And throughout Asia, if you have a banquet or you have a wedding, you want to show off, you want to serve shark fin soup.
So it's a delicacy. Hold on. Does it taste particularly good, or is it just a show-off thing where I can afford shark fin soup? Because I'm told that these shark fins sell for like $300 a pound.
Yeah, there is virtually no taste in the fin at all. In fact, they have to add spices to make it palatable. It's strictly prestigious. And it goes back to the Chinese emperors in 1000 AD who served it at that time. And so it's just a cultural issue. There's no reason to be serving the shark fin soup.
Wow.
And beyond that, though, the one thing in the book that I talk about is that, you know, these ships that are out there in the Pacific Ocean, they're primarily hunting tuna, and they catch shark in the process. Now, they could let the sharks go, but they decide not to because, as you point out, those fins are incredibly valuable. And the sad thing is that there is slavery taking place out on the high seas, and these poor men on these boats who aren't getting paid, they do make some money from selling the fins to Asian countries. So that gives them a few dollars that they have. And so this is all tied into the human tragedy of slavery and ultimately why we as consumers get tuna fish so cheaply at the supermarket for $1.99 a can.
Yeah, this is something this is something I knew nothing about. There are people, men, who are, I guess, enslaved, and they're put on these ships, and they're not allowed to get off. And their whole job is to catch these fish. They don't get off the boat. They're there for however long they're in captivity, right?
That's right. Sometimes, Mike, they're on the boat for 2 to 3 years at a time. And what they'll do, these ships will transfer their catch onto what's called a reefer ship, which is a giant container ship. That ship goes back to port, and they'll refuel the fishing vessel. They'll stay at sea, again, 2 or 3 years, and these men, their lives are, some of them are ruined by the time they come back. And if they try to struggle, reach out, some of them are killed. It is modern-day slavery in its worst form, and it happens because they're thousands of miles away at sea, away from prying eyes, and it is a great human tragedy as well as for the sharks.
Dr. Fadri, you are part of the Shark Survey Program at UNC Chapel Hill's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City. You tag sharks off the Carolina coast, the North Carolina coast. Have you noticed a decline in the number of sharks in our waters, or is it about the same over time?
Well, there has been a decline over the almost 50-year survey program. So the survey started, you know, right around 1970, and this decline in large sharks was observed sort of through the 80s, and sort of a change in the species assemblage. So where we used to have more duskies and sandbars and silkies, we're now fairly dominated by sharp nose and black nose, and these are sort of smaller sharks. You know, I'm sort of myopically focused on my part of the world, and it's good to be reminded about some of these global issues. But I will say that the Southeast, I think, also shows that there may be reason for some optimism, or at least shows what's possible. NOAA Fisheries does surveys of sharks sort of farther offshore, and there's some evidence in their data within the Southeast that we may be seeing the start of some recovery. In our own survey, which is sort of focused here in Central North Carolina along the coast, I don't think we're showing any further decreases, and we may be starting to see the a corner be turned. As a for instance, we used to catch tiger sharks in our surveys, but starting around 1990, that just stopped. And from 1990 until 2010, we didn't catch any tiger sharks. And then starting in 2010, now we're catching two and three a year again. And that's, you know, very encouraging.
Could that be because of migratory patterns changing with the temperature of the water?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. What was interesting is that it used to be that tiger sharks could be caught in the summer and the fall. And so far in this last 10-year period, we only catch them very late in the year.
So I have a minute left in this segment, and I mentioned Dr. Burgess in Georgia, who keeps the International Shark Attack file.
In Florida.
But we don't have we've had more shark attacks in our area this summer than normal. Is that just happenstance? Is that a shape of things to come? To what do you attribute that?
Well, in this year, I'm only aware of three. So it is an increase above that average of one a year, but it's still a remarkably low number, and it's so rare an event that it would be hard to say if it's a trend. If there is any change in it going from one bite a year to three, I expect it largely deals with just how many people we have at the coast. We're talking about, you know, 0.00010. So when you're dealing with very low numbers and lots of zeros, it's hard to plot any trend.
There's more to talk about with regard to sharks and what they do in the oceans and what they do for the oceans, and we'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sharks on this August day. William McKeever is the author of Emperors of the Deep, the ocean's most mysterious, most misunderstood, and most important guardians. We'll talk about why they are important in a moment. And Dr. Joel Fodry is with us, a marine ecologist and associate professor at UNC Chapel Hill Institute of Marine Scientists. If there are so many sharks in the oceans that we can kill 100 million of them every year and still have more sharks to kill, how much more time do we have until they're gone?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think right now we just don't know the number of how many sharks are out there in the oceans. We do know that once you get particularly outside of the United States, that there are many areas where these large sharks have been fished out. And the time is running out for them. And how long they have, we don't know. But the point is that these sharks, as apex predators, are crucial to the marine ecosystem. So the analogy on land is wolves. And you may remember in Yellowstone, when they took the wolves out, it had an immediate effect on Yellowstone. The rivers actually meandered more. The species were affected. And they brought the wolves back. And the rivers flowed straighter. And species came back and revived Yellowstone. The same thing happens in the ocean when you take the sharks out. It devastates reef systems, seagrass systems. So we humans really can't take the chance of continuing this trend, because once we get to the point where we've taken the sharks out, we have permanently damaged the ecosystem.
Is another analogy the bee analogy? We've talked a lot about the concern over the disappearance of bees and honeybee colony collapse because of the roles that they play in pollinating our crops. And it said, as the bees go, so do we. No bees, no us, because they pollinate our food. Is it safe to say that sharks play a similar role in the ocean?
Yeah, I would say that's actually a good analogy. And in the oceans, there are around the world 500 million people rely on fishing for their existence. And in Asian countries, they rely on fish for their seafood. In this country, we don't eat as much seafood, sadly. And we need those sharks to maintain the systems that provide the jobs and the food that people eat. And in every ecosystem out there in the ocean, whether it's seagrass, tiger sharks are out there protecting those seagrass beds that are so important for little fish to grow up. Sharks are out there in the reef systems, making sure that there's no one species that monopolizes any resource and keeping that reef healthy. So all those systems rely on apex predators to maintain the balance. It's so crucial for the future.
I think it was you, Mr. McKeever, that said it's the wild, wild west, particularly in the Pacific Ocean. And we've heard about the Japanese whaling industry and how they're kind of going against international maritime law by engaging in certain practices. Is the same thing true of sharks? Do they have such a need to feed a burgeoning population that they really can't afford to be following international law?
I know. I think that it's these Asian countries, particularly China, are overexploiting the oceans. And instead of looking at the oceans as a sustainable source of seafood, they don't have the conservation mindset that we have in this country. And so, as we've seen with elephants and lions and tigers, the Chinese just have a different mindset. And that is damaging the world's oceans to our detriment and to even their detriment. What we can do is put in laws around the world that will provide for sustainable fishing. It can be done, but it just right now we allow this sort of behavior to happen. And we should get a lot tougher with these Asian countries and how they overexploit the oceans.
The UNC Institute of Marine Sciences, Dr. Fadri, has the country's oldest, longest-running shark research program, but you focus mainly along the North Carolina coast. Why do we have that program? What was the impetus for starting it and continuing it?
Well, it really was just a credit to one of our former faculty members, an ichthyologist named Frank Schwartz, who had this curiosity about sharks, wanted to know more. We're certainly right there with a unique data set that now spans nearly five decades. And it's very much a grassroots effort at this point. Our staff, multiple faculty, multiple students get out and help run this program. It's very hard to fund research even over 2 or 3 years. And so to have this program now just about to reach 50 years is quite remarkable. And it's every other week, spring, summer, and fall. We go off 1 mile off the beach and 7 miles off the beach. We do use that long line gear, 1 kilometer of long line with 100 hooks, 100 baited hooks. It soaks for 1 hour, at which point we pull the line in and we see what sharks are in the area. We do try to get all the data we can in terms of species and lengths and sex, et cetera. We tag those individuals and return them back to the water when possible.
Wow. Your book, William McKeever, concentrates on four species, mako, tiger, hammerhead, and the great white. Let's start there, because the great white shark is the one that has been dubbed our nemesis because of the role that a species plays in Jaws. Are they the most dangerous sharks to humans?
Well, yeah, well, certainly if you look at the history, that the top three in terms of attacks on humans, one would be great white, two would be tiger, and then after that, it's not quite clear what it is. It might be bull sharks, but most of the time, people can't make out the shark that has bitten them. So yes, great whites, they're one of the biggest sharks out there. But again, it's very unusual. I would point out that most of the attacks on humans are actually on surfers, because they're doing the activity that's creating the most noise, but also they look like a prey item to a shark. And again, those great white sharks are feeding on seals, sea lions. That's their main food source that they need.
And it's been said that at least in the Northeast, that's the reason we have a rise in the incidence of attacks by humans, because the sharks are coming in to be with the sea lion, to get the sea lions, and the sea lion population up there has been increasing. Is that accurate?
That's right. Seals have been recovering, and they are all over the Cape, and that's bringing in the great white sharks. Now, this is an interesting point, because if you're a commercial fisherman, you don't want to see an overpopulation of seals, because that's going to affect your fishing ability. And so they actually need great white sharks to control the seal population. So it's a mistake to take the go after the great whites, and in fact, rightly so, the United States bans the killing of great whites because of their importance to the ecosystem. So we need to think in different ways about how we interact and live with these great white sharks, and that is, as they do in other countries, share the ocean with them and realize they're going to be out there, they're not going away, we don't want them to go away anyway, and just to be more cautious and thoughtful about how we interact with them.
It's obvious why your book writes about in your book The Great White Shark, but why did you choose the Mako, the Tiger, and the Hammerhead as the other three that you focus on?
Yeah, those are the big sharks that have the most attention, if you will. And science has been, in the last 5-10 years, discovering amazing things about these sharks that I wanted to bring out into the public's mind. In the case of the Mako, this is the fastest shark in the ocean. They can travel 45 miles an hour, equivalent to the horses in the Kentucky Derby. They range around the world, and they are incredibly smart as apex predators. And I would point out there has never been one recorded death from a Mako shark. And yet in tournaments around the country, Mako sharks are one of the prized fish. And in the Northeast, Mako sharks were just designated as endangered. So I find it unconscionable to be fishing Makos in tournaments when they are these remarkable animals so crucial to the ecosystem. Now, when I go after Makos, then tiger sharks. To me, they're remarkably beautiful. They're smart. They're ambush sharks. And they play a very important role around the world. I describe this in the book, in protecting seagrass systems, because the tiger sharks are really the only ones big and strong enough that can keep the grazers on the seagrass, the dugongs, the sea cows, to keep them from literally ripping up the seagrass. And we need those seagrasses to provide habitat for small fish as well as to capture carbon. So if we lose the sharks, we actually may make the global climate change even worse, because we're losing the seagrasses. And then the hammerhead shark is another magnificent animal. That shark has these wonderful electroreceptors on its head, and they can actually sense creatures that are buried in the sand. They know where they are, even though they can't see them. And they patrol up and down the around the world, and they get to tremendous size. They're remarkably beautiful. The fin that they have is sometimes 3 feet in length, and yet they're actually a very delicate creature. When they are caught in these tournaments, they're the ones most likely to die if they're released. You know, you think they're big and strong and they can take a beating, but when they're caught on the line and released, most of them will die. And
why?
And they're very susceptible. Well, because they build up in a fight on a line. They're fighting for their lives. They're horrified, of course. They're suffering. The lactic acid builds up in their muscle. When they are pulled up to the boat, sometimes they're banged against the boat. That damages their internal organs. Tiger sharks do fare better in these studies that are done about what sharks can survive being released, but hammerheads just do not. And they just are not equipped by nature to survive these encounters.
I'd like to hear from both of you about how intelligent these animals are, because you've written that the sharks are smart. Somebody said, and it may have been you, that they're smarter perhaps than dolphins, and we all praise dolphins for their intelligence, probably because of Flipper and and SeaWorld. How do we know they're smart? How do they exhibit their intelligence?
Well, I'll chime in first on that one, and that is that there have been studies in the Bahamas about sharks and how they socialize with each other. And actually, they create friendships, and they have developed ways of traveling together and actually learning from other sharks. The juveniles in the mangroves will see how the bigger sharks operate. This research was done in the Bimini Shark Lab, and Makos have been they've been working with them, testing their intelligence. And now, would I say that sharks are smarter than dolphins? I'm not sure that may be the case, but I think sharks, as apex predators, are certainly a lot more intelligent than fish, and have over the eons developed ways with working in their environment that they learn how to hunt on their own. Keep in mind, they don't have any mother to teach them. Great whites over decades have to learn to catch sea lions and seals, and that's, I think, shows to their intelligence.
Hmm. Dr. Fodry, same question if you have an answer for it, and if not, we could talk about what people don't know about sharks that might surprise them.
Well, I just like to think of them as highly evolved. They are clearly extremely capable. They have this diversity of sensory systems they use, you know, vision, smell, electric fields, sound. That's allowed that guild of fish to radiate and be successful. They are certainly facing a unique challenge when it comes to fishing pressure that they've not adapted to sort of compete with us. But beyond that, they're clearly very successful and highly adapted is the way I like to think of sharks.
How many shark bites were there in the United States last year? Do you remember the number?
According to the International Shark Attack File, in 2018, there were 32 attacks in the United States. The five-year average is 50 to 55. So we actually had a decline in the number of attacks last year.
Now, and how many of them led to fatalities?
There was one fatality in the United States in 2018 off of Truro, off the Cape of Cod. That was the first fatality up there since the 1930s. It was a great white shark.
No.
And again, on average, there's less than one death in the United States.
I asked that question because in 2018, there were 36 dog bite-related fatalities in the United States. And we don't talk about that. We talk about sharks. We're scared to death of sharks. According to some source that I read yesterday, your chances of getting bitten are, you're 23 times more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to be bitten by a shark. And out of the 91 million swimmers in the oceans bordering this country, there are only about 44 shark attacks a year, only 17 fatal attacks in 20 years. You should be more afraid of riptides than you are of sharks. So some of the tips, what should we look out for? Is there a way to know, if you're in the surf, that sharks are there too?
Well, what I would like to just add to that is that I think people are afraid of the stakes. I mean, certainly when one of these bites happens, it can ruin your day for sure. It can change your life. And in that very, very rare case, someone may die. And, you know, we don't want to make light of that and be glib about that. But if people were to focus on the odds, they wouldn't give sharks a second thought. The odds are so incredibly low. To sort of feed into those data that were just being talked about, it's been well over a decade in North Carolina since anyone died. And just this year alone, we've had over 10 deaths due to rip currents. So you're exactly right to highlight the relative risk. And so our beaches are fairly safe, but it's the ocean. You have to be aware of things, and that includes the animals, but certainly the riptides and other, you know, the sun and all the other threats of sort of being outside.
Yeah. I'm told that if you see birds diving into the water and people catching fish, that's an indicator that perhaps sharks may be nearby because they're trying to catch fish, as are the birds. So what can we do, very quickly, William McKeever, you only have 30 seconds left, what can we do to help in conservation efforts?
Yeah, I think, first of all, that when you're buying seafood, that you want to make sure that there were no slaves involved, that it was caught sustainably. So find out where your seafood is from. And if it's American caught, that's probably a good idea that you're safe, because we have the rules and regulations in place that other countries don't do. I think, too, is to look into local conservation efforts, local groups, join them, get educated, help to educate other people about sharks and about how the marine environment that we need to protect it. And I think if we're smarter consumers and we have a concern about these issues, that we can go a long way to turning this around.
William McKeever, author of Emperors of the Deep, The Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians, and Dr. Joel Fodry, marine ecologist with UNC Chapel Hill's Institute for Marine Sciences. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.